thinking lately. Now and then, you know. But lately about Ronnie Scott, who came. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people here, and thanks for coming. Truly. Always a privilege to play, but it's better when there are people there, you know. But Ronnie Scott came on stage one night in London at a club called Ronnie Scott's. He's a great saxophone player. And looked into the room and he said, I should have stayed in bed. There are more people there. That's, yep. I've decided to install a device here. I've no idea why. Oh, I know why. The tune I want to do here, if I play it, it's usually at the end of the set. So I'm kind of freaking myself out. It's good for me, but it doesn't necessarily pay off. Thank you. I'm sorry. I have to say this because it's so appropriate. I mean, this actually sounds like something. Sounds like something. I played a show with Steve Goodman and Jethro Burns. If you ever saw them together, it was even better than Steve by himself, which is hard to imagine. And I mentioned to Jethro after the show that I had once played a benefit for the golfing poor of Aspen. And I said, it was sort of like being ignored, you know? I was really irrelevant to the thing, but it was a closed sort of shop. It wasn't a public promotion, so I figured I could get away with it. And I told him, you know, in the middle of the, wasn't the middle, it was the first quarter of the set that I was playing. The audience was so loud that the guy who booked me in there stepped up over this lip of the stage right here, right in front of me, while I was singing. And he walked up to me like a moon, and he said, "I'm sorry. You don't have to do this." Ring, ring, comes, and I'm singing. So I stopped singing. They didn't, you know, they didn't. I could, you know, and that's what I told them. I said, "Look, I can do anything up here. I'm not going to stop. I've never had an experience like it." We had sort of a conversation. He eventually left the stage. And Jethro said, "Oh, I know exactly what you mean." He said, if you're not familiar with Homer and Jethro, they were an ostensible novelty act, but what they truly were two virtuosos. Very funny guys. And great players. And they when they were hot, they were on cornflakes boxes, and Jethro said, on one of those tours, we'd been out for 3-4 months working our asses off, and we came to a 1,000-seat ballroom in North Carolina, where not one ticket had been sold. We knew that because the promoter was there to scare us. And that usually means, you know, that 50 or 100 have been sold, but zero. I've never heard of that happening. Zero tickets. And Jethro said, we were delighted because, you know, we were tired. And he said, "We'll give you back your advance and, you know, no harm. We can all go home." And the guy said, "No, I think there'll be a walk-up." Population of the town was probably 3,000. He thought a third of the population was going to rush the stage at the last minute. And Jethro said, and this is the part that, I mean, there's more, but I love this. Jethro said, "We did it." And they played to a completely empty ballroom. There wasn't one stumbler in. Complete silence, complete void. You know, cast your pearls before swine, and they come back at you. Get a face full of pearls, or just a vibrating silence. If you're lucky, it's vibrating. And he said, "We did our whole thing," and which was, you know, who knows, an hour and a half, 2 hours. He said, "And then we walked off and we took an encore." One more way to deal with an empty house. Oops. Couldn't find my thumb there for a minute. Thank you. My grandmother was a very quiet woman, soft-spoken. I never knew her all that well, but I knew one thing about her. She liked to fish, and when she went fishing, she exploded. It was Jekyll and Hyde woman. She used a cane pole, a worm, a bobber, and went after the sunfish in a lake called Clark. And from the minute the worm submerged, she was yelling at the fish, grumbling, chain smoking, throwing them in the lake to poison the fish. Would just become furious. This is why I usually demurred when I was invited along. I wish I hadn't done that. But I was there often enough to know the full depth of her rage. So that later on, as a hapless young fellow, I wrote this thing. It's called The Fisherman. Thank you. climbed the steps and tried the door and let myself in. The kitchen clock I used to watch had stopped at 5 to 5. A photograph I'd never seen. A car came up the drive. I stood outside the kitchen door, and when she turned her head, I said that I was back to stay. She laughed at what I said. Stillman's made 2 records with Bill Evans. I have not heard either one of them, and I can't understand that. I'm a Bill Evans hog. There are two pieces, each one less than over an hour, that you could find somewhere on YouTube. One was a weekly jazz hour on the BBC. Playing with, anyhow, I've forgotten now, the rhythm section. And the other is in Finland, and he's in a sort of a living room with 2 other guys I can't remember. Chuck Israel's on, no, Eddie Gomez on bass, and Marty Morell on drums. They're phenomenal. Just extraordinary. It's live. Well, he died a long time ago, but I mean, it's, you know what I mean. Miracle of tape. The hell of digital. But digital's great for distribution and archiving. At any rate, at one point, there's a great biography of Bill Evans written by another piano player named Pettinger. And there's a little bit in there about Toots and Bill. They ran out of things to play, which is not usually a problem in their line of work. And Toots said, well, I've got something that just, you know, just goes from F to A. Why don't we do that? And I thought, I could do that. Pretty sure I don't do it the way they did it. or as Leon Redbone once said to me, boy, when you want to go somewhere, you just go there, don't you? Why not? Thigh tells me. Draft. Thank you. Things aren't as weird as they used to be. They seem a little more deflated than they were one time. So I had a brief career on a submarine and I was up in the sail, standing watch, sweeping the horizon with my binoculars. So I didn't see until I faced directly forward that the ocean was rising in front of us, and the officer, the OD or whoever it was, down here in this little pocket where he could be out of the spray, had his back turned to the, you know, the way the boat was going. I thought that was negligent of him, actually. And I was trying to think, because they hadn't taught me how to announce that something, that the ocean was rising up before us. It sounded way too biblical to me for something military. And so I didn't say anything, and we hit it. And it stopped the boat, which is, you know, they're heavy, and the boat rose up on top of it. I think it was Herbie's type, actually, is who we hit. And we're hanging there. It was unpleasant. And because I was, you know, so new and so stupid, I wasn't upset. I thought it was interesting. I looked down to see what Herbie looked like now. This is actually a wish fulfillment, to have struck Herbie Stipe with a submarine. Simmering, sort of recurring grudge things. A kid I knew when I was in the third grade. The evil Herbie. And I looked down, and there was this, whatever it was so big that the ocean was still a hump. I mean, vast. And as I looked down, the water was rushing off whatever held up the, hadn't yet broken, was just now breaking the surface tension. And I saw something gray with little yellow, and they weren't barnacles, little yellow things sticking up. It looked to be about that far, and they were all wiggling against the force of the ocean running over them. That was weird. I left a note about this on some record when I was actually a little over two years old, and I got to confirm this. I thought this had to have been a dream. I jumped in the lake and I sank like a stone. I didn't know anything. For some reason, I wanted to be merged with the lake, and this was Clark Lake again. And I remember sinking to the bottom. Your bottom, Abby, when you're about 2 years old. I remember sinking to the bottom, and I don't remember having much of a thought about anything. But what I do remember is a bubble issued from around my neck like this and wrapped around my head, and I could see out through the bubble, and there were about three or four really miserable scraggly weeds, and I could breathe in the bubble. You believe that? I don't believe it either. And decades later, and that's all I could remember about this. Decades later, my mother was up cleaning out that cabin where this had all happened, I mean, on the lake where this had happened. And I asked her about it. I said, weren't you there? How did I get out of that? She said, well, your Aunt Rui pulled you out. She was there. And it's funny you mention this, she said, because your Aunt Rui asked me what I meant. And I don't know what she was talking about when she said, well, you know, when he jumped in the lake and sank and I pulled him out, he said, I blowed up. Thank you, Rui. I'll cancel my reservation at Wilmer State Hospital. The only other thing I want to mention is that I can't mention it. It's so damn long. We'll just say that this is, I kind of have to. I'll compress it. I've played it. It's one of the first times I played in Hamburg. An old couple came back, this is in the 70s, and said, our name is Kottke. I said, I'm leaving, I have to be going now. And they said, no, we're not related. I said, oh. And they said, we have something you should see. And they showed me a playbill from about, I don't remember the year, 1911, it was pre-World War I. And they said, this was the last concert given by a very famous pianist here in Germany named Kottke. She was 23 years old the year this concert was performed in Berlin, and she died right after this concert at age 23. And I said, oh. And they handed me the playbill. He held on to it. There was a little tug. And there she was. She was wearing a bustle and had that round, piled-up hair. And she's in the dimple of the piano. And it was me in a bustle with a big head of hair at age 23. It wasn't an uncanny resemblance. It was me. And that's another one I thought about for a long time. In order to put it to rest, I had to accept that at one point I tired of the piano, wanted to play something more portable, and was willing to give up my gender and my life to do it. Which is another reason I thank you for being here today. Are those seats cheaper back there? I asked. Excuse me. I usually know what this is. It's the catering, and it's usually a carrot or a piece of celery. But I meet up with it again out here. You don't need to know this, really. So, this is called Gewerbegebiet. This is the most beautiful word in the German language. I gotta say this. I was in the right around there. I was thinking about what I thought I might have forgotten in the previous tune. You shouldn't think while you're up here. Usually you don't have to. I mean, usually your head's so empty you can hear the wind through the room, which is the hook. I mean, that's what's great about performance. You just disappear. But that floated through. Did I play the bridge in that thing? I don't think I played the bridge in it. And then I realized I didn't know where I was in this one. And then, you know, you make something up. And I suddenly longed for a night in an empty ballroom in North Carolina, 1962. I was doing a show with another one with Steve Goodman in Calgary once, and on that day, Steve had been in remission for 12 years. I think I can say this. He decided to celebrate, and he ate some mushrooms, on stage, and we were playing an empty rodeo ground. There was an audience, but they were so far away, only a bull could really hold them. But they were helpful, you know, they realized that how difficult it must have been for the performer. Because really, you just looked out through a huge expanse of dried mud and began to admire the ridges and the depressions. And the guy who had given Steve the mushrooms, this was shortly after, no, it couldn't have been. Anyhow, there was probably a permanent thing. There was a snow fence over here at a distance. And the mushroom giver decided to vault the snow fence, and he got hung up on it just like that, on a snow fence. It was wonderful to see. And I was watching that, and I wonder, how do you get off of that? Wouldn't it be risky to get off of it? When Steve walked off, he thought he was done, and which he was, he hadn't fulfilled the terms of his contract. And the promoter was standing there, and he said, "Where are you going? You've only played for half an hour there." And Steve, he did another, one of these great things. He said, "Oh," and he went out and he played one half hour encore. The mud rose up to congratulate him. It was something. Nobody wanted to follow Steve. That was a real play on his career. I mean, people, you just couldn't, the room was gone when he walked out. And I would beg him to close, and he wouldn't do it. Last night that we played together, I was insisting. I said, "Look, let's flip a coin. I mean, this really isn't right." And this was on a phone conversation. When I got there, he'd hired a referee. He became an official NFL guy with his suit on and a big coin, and he flipped the coin, and I lost. It was Steve's coin. This is another favorite, written by another favorite of mine, Pete Seeger. This is one of his best instrumentals. It's a great instrumental. When I met Pete for the first time, I asked him for his phone number, and he drew me a map to his house instead. And I live in Minnesota. Hotel room with my manager at the time. While recording my first record for Capitol. And it had been a difficult day because, you know, you're on a budget, a deadline, and all of that. And, the label had hated most of my first effort, and so somebody from the label said, you need to go to Nashville. Well, I didn't want to go there, so we went to Mount Juliet in a garage that belonged to Wayne Moss's mom, and we couldn't find the drummer. He didn't show up. Clock was ticking. We needed the drummer. The label insisted on the drummer. They'd insisted on the whole rhythm section. So had Denny, my manager. And we were standing around in the murk wondering what we could do now. It seemed fairly obvious to me, but not to anybody else. When and the drummer, I mean the piano, that's right, it wasn't the drummer, it was a piano player. Excuse me. Who'd been in a lake breathing in a bubble of his own manufacturing. Anyhow, the piano player rose up, that's how I got it confused, he rose up in the drum cage, you know, all these baffles, and he rose up like a wraith. Sort of shimmered into being and from a cloud of Placidil, as it turned out. Dr. John, he was not Mac Rabbi, but actually a doctor. John, well, he had been a doctor, he'd been disbarred. Or he'd lost his license, I don't know. He's an amazing piano player, but you know, and he would never mention why he'd been kicked out of the profession. But you could tell when you played with him, because he'd take you out somewhere that was just glittering and wonderful, and you're following him around, and he would just stop. He'd just kind of peter off into nowhere, like he'd run down a gopher hole and leave you there. I could imagine a couple tonsillectomies going wrong. Excuse me, I'm imagining now. Like a stone on the water, I can't help but see. goes so hard when I'm tuning them. It makes them go sharp. It penetrates the crowd in a way they don't appreciate. If I used monitors, I'd probably hit them a little lighter, a little more considerate. But I'm scared to death of monitors. It's like looking into a mirror really hard for a long time. I once recorded a tune that came out of sort of an improvisation with my friend Billy Peterson in the studio. And we liked what we did, but it wasn't quite enough, so I recited a sort of, drama it made up on top of it involving a woman who lives in a bus. And she's picked up by a guy in a pickup truck and takes her out to his place out in the country. And he says, "You want to have some dinner?" And she says, "Yeah." I get out of the, actually, that's not in the, they're just standing out of the side of the truck. And you want to come, whatever. I mean, it's implied, sort of a literary device. And so they're about to go into the house, and he doesn't want to stink up the place, so he extinguishes his cigar on the dog. She says, "Hell with you, take me back to the bus." So that's the bus. And I thought that was really brilliant, but then my masterstroke showed up like a little cloud a little later on. She'd been sitting in the bus for hours thinking about why men are like this or whatever she's thinking. We don't know that. When back down the same road over the spaces in the overpass, past the cigarette butts chirping by the roadway, past the pecan trees and the dust, the dog bursts into flame. Wow. It's been smoldering all that time. It's like those movies they used to show us of a closet full of rags. Showed us so much stuff just to scare us. I remember a movie called The Long Way Home about a little girl who, imagine this, it's a grade school kid who takes a shortcut through the railroad yard. Squish. Oh, thank you. We are enlightened now. Anyhow, the record came out and I realized that it wasn't quite as fascinating a story as I had thought. And then years, decades later, I was outdoors in San Diego, I came off the stage, I was going back to the dressing rooms and Barney Kessel was standing out there. And I jumped the snow fence and I went out to Barney and he said, I told him who he was, that kind of thing. "Here, Barney." And he said, did you live in Muskogee? I said, "Yeah." I said, "That's where I got my first guitar." He said, "I learned to play guitar in Muskogee." Barney Kessel is a bop pioneer on guitar, just a wonderful musician. And I was amazed at that. He said, "Well, not only did I learn in Muskogee, I learned from a Hawaiian lap steel player working for the in one of the WPA programs in the New Deal." Hawaiian lap steel taught Barney Kessel, who had harmonies that I don't have a clue about. No. And I was standing there kind of pinching myself to be talking to him, and I realized there was this little girl standing here about 8 years old, and she'd been there all along, and I'd been trying to pick Barney's brain, and I realized she'd been there, and I said, "Hello," and she's got that stern look that a little kid can get, and she's in her, they'll stand very straight like that, with her arms kind of back. And I said, "Hello." And she said, "Why did the dog have to burn?" It's Mr. Asshole to you, kid. How do you explain that one? When the storm's up in the sky, when the night's along the street, when the TV's in the motel shine, when the fingertips are frozen, when the empty wind starts blowing, if they've got one, they're all going home. We're just sitting here all by myself. Nobody else but me. Sometimes the only light's the night we see. Every night somebody's crying down the alley on the cold, cold ground. Someone's running, but they'll never, ever leave. There's a shadow underneath a tree. Someone running, someone no one needs. Sometimes the only light, the night we see. There's a shadow underneath a tree. Someone running, someone no one needs. Sometimes the only light's the night. Something behind me. Wow. No. Sorry. Yeah, that's behind enough, I gotta admit. It's I don't have a set list because if you have one, it shows. I mean, if you're the only thing up here and you've got a set list, it's like watching a, you know, newspaper. It's just dead in the water. And the reason I talk so much, and I really am trying to curtail that, is that if I don't say something, it doesn't really even matter what I say, I don't know what to play next. In the beginning, I'd get up there and I'd know exactly what I wanted, but I'd played it 20 minutes ago, or I couldn't think of anything that would, you know, sort of fit. It took a long time to figure out how all that works. Well, I'll sneak up on the end of this with a tune that was written, usually people will say as an homage to somebody. Well, to somebody. But what that is really is just, it's just a theft of somebody. I mean, it has to be. You wouldn't even recognize it. So this is an attempted thievery involving a great Telecaster player who worked in Miami on a lot of disco records called Little Beaver. Once again, it's always a privilege to play. Thank you for coming out to... The sound system is new since the last time I was here. So much nicer. Thanks. Yeah, it used to be a real hard high-end. Everybody had to kind of fight it. Now I know why they put you behind. Yeah, woof woof. That's, I agree. Thank you. Thank you. always stuff I forget. I try to play everything I remember. This is a tune that was written by a guy named Burt Camford, who had a lot of big hits around the world, really. He was the first person to record the Beatles for some label in Germany. And this was his biggest hit. Like a lot of his tunes, they sound as if they were written on or for the guitar. Thank you.